life. As an organizer, it's different. I feel different. This is a moment where people have said enough is enough, and they mean it this time.
No peace! No peace! No peace!
Voices of protest in New York. Special thanks to John Hamilton and Iyada Faga, and to Sadie Lutmer in Minneapolis. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people as possible on site. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. If you want to sign up for our daily digest, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tabe Mari, a studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen Honey Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Is KBOO Portland. We are creeping up on the 8 a.m. hour. It's Monday, and that means it's time for more talk radio with your host, this time Cecil Prescott. Stay tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio. Take it away, Cecil. You are live.
Good morning. Good morning. This is Monday, June 8th, 2020, and you are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO FM. That's 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany region, and KBOO.FM via the World Wide Web. This is More Talk Radio, and I will be joined shortly, with my fingers crossed, by my co-host Celeste Carey. And just want to begin this morning by having us all to stop. These are some wild times we are living in, and I hope among everything that we are taking the time to reflect, to pause, and to take action. It's a continuum. It's circular almost. It isn't one thing or the other. It's as if I view it as going up a circular stairway. So we take action, we reflect by ourselves and with one another, we pause and think about why we do what we do, and think about what we did, reflect, perhaps make some modification, and then we take action again. It's a continuing circle in these times, and it's an opportunity for us to not only take action, but also to have the opportunity to care about who we are and what we are doing. I got a lot of messages from Celeste last evening as I was, I was asleep, and I kept on hearing bing, bing, bing on my phone. And so I just said, Celeste, you know, you are staying active late at night. And a lot of good
sleep.
Articles that
I could
we
not
had
sleep.
An opportunity. Mm.
No.
But maybe that's a good way to begin. It's just checking in to see how we are doing. So have you been, I know last night was difficult to sleep. Have you been able to rest and find your rest? I know I've been having some very strange dreams, and you know, I'm sure my therapist will have lots of explanation about those, but how have you been able to take care of yourself, Celeste?
In a word, I have totally detached from news and all of that. There is no watching this for me. I think for people my age who have been through a lot of the, and I'll pull the curtain back a little bit on my life, I've been through a lot of horrendous mess. I endure post-traumatic stress, among other things. Some of the things I've been through include dealing with police, but just being a person of color in this racist machinery. I mean, just about all my life I've been in predominantly white institutions and organizations, you know, from the time of as a child, because my siblings and I were bright, bright children. We were trotted out like, you know, little trained beings to perform whenever the school needed somebody bright to come out, which incurred the ire of white kids and black kids. And, you know, being singled out in that fashion is not a blessing. And then I had the audacity to always be part of some of the sanctum sanctorum of white supremacy. I went to a prestigious white Jesuit university. I had the audacity to go to a top-notch journalism school. I was a cadet in the Air Force. Just things that put me in a weird place in terms of having to deal with institutional racism. At the university I went to, there were two of us of color in honors, and it's no small feat to be in the honors department in a Jesuit university, but I was made to pay for it, you know, and everything from comments like N-word, what are you doing here, on a regular basis, to just mistreatment by instructors and classmates and what have you. And you know, there's a certain point as you look at the fact that now you're in your 30s and 40s and older, that you're going through this, that it not only takes its toll, it puts you in this position of defensiveness, because you have to defend your inner being. You cannot withstand this indefinitely. And I found that when I came to the city, when I worked for the city of Portland, and some colleagues and I put together this project that was called the Restorative Listening Project on Gentrification, that I had put myself in a cauldron of boiling oil. And that was a real difficult situation, because we were trying to get people in Portland to recognize how racism is the foundation of Western white culture, and that white supremacy is the mortar, if not the very bricks and mortar, that holds white culture up in America. And so I found that having conversations with people to help them hear the story of those who had gone through this was sometimes therapeutic, but most time a lot more trial than we expected. And that was part of my negative adventure, I guess I say, in community organizing and community building in Portland. And one of the things people ask me when they ask me, you know, what is life in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest been like, I tell them life in Portland has been interesting in that this is the best place and the absolute worst place I have ever lived to been in my life. It's best because if you can navigate it, if you can find a place to rest and regroup, you can be what you want to be, who you want to be, do things that matter. But by the same point, this is the most racist place I've ever been in my entire life. And I've been in 45, if not 44, I mean 46 of the states in this union, and parts of Canada and parts of Mexico. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, my God, what have I got myself into? Seeing all of this in terms of the struggles and the protests should be invigorating, but it's not, because human nature tells me that it's entirely possible that people are only surface motivated. This is what I want to say. It's the cause du jour. That's what I was saying last night. You know.
Yes.
And so I find myself in a position of extreme fatigue. I'm too tired to even be angry. I'm just tired. And I don't feel like dealing with all the things that have come with this, which is now my white friends and family members and compatriots and people in my heart know me. And they've reached out in a way that's appropriate and supportive like a friend would. But for all of these other people who want me to educate them, or they want to be told, we're not the bad white people, are we? You know, I don't have time and energy for that. I don't. And you need to figure out, you need to figure out what to do, because white culture knows how to take, white culture knows how to take stock of, analyze, create metrics for, quantify, qualify everything. If you really care to understand and dismantle racism as a culture, you would have done it. Because you figured out how to oppress people very precisely, yet you, as a culture, not individual people, I'm talking about as a culture of dominance, for some reason, all that collective knowledge and skill and acumen seems to fail you. I find that to be kind of disingenuous when you say, what can we do? It's like you know what to do. But here it is, 2020, the year of perfect vision, and people are blind.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on community radio station KBOO. Today is Monday, the 8th of June, and you are listening in on a conversation with Celeste Carey, who you just heard, and Cecil Prescott. That must be mean. Me. And, you know, Celeste, you shared many points just now, and I just wanted to maybe touch upon a couple of them. You know, we've known one another for years, decades, and experienced many challenges, many adventures here in the city of Portland. There were several things that you said, and I just wanted us to have the opportunity to reflect and maybe expand on those things. Among the things you said experienced, you know, extreme fatigue, and not also acknowledging that people in your life who reach out to you, and but also, you know, just not wanting to be once again the educator and sort of explain things. And I think many of us, I as well, sometimes I'm saying, no, you know, that's not my job today, and I'm not here to explain the mechanics or why white supremacy is a reality. And sometimes, quite frankly, I'm in a place right now where I think you mentioned fatigue. I may be similar, and also not wanting to. I just want to say, you know, don't talk to me right now, and maybe another day we can have a discussion. But I am not going to sit here and be used. And you, well, I'll explain how I feel. Be used by you to make you feel good. And a friend of mine, a few days ago, she mentioned the encounter she had with a good white person who wanted, you know, some explanation or some bend her ear, and it went on and on and on, and she was frustrated. She said, "But one thing I did get out of it, I got a nice donation to my organization I work for." So, you know, maybe that it was worth it for her. But, you know, sometimes for me, it's like, okay, enough for now, and let's carry on. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
You know, if it works for her, good. You know, maybe this is a form of reparations for some people.
A down payment of reparations, yeah.
I don't have the energy anymore, you know. There's so many anecdotes and homilies we have about how to treat each other. But the fascinating thing is, again, this willful blindness to how to treat folks of color. And I remember when I was young, and it occurred to me, why does white culture and white people control everything? And I thought, they're not necessarily superior, and having, like I said, gone to white schools and lived in white neighborhoods all my life and pretty much been run ragged by people even trying to go to the simple library or grocery store or walk home from school, you know, or take a music class or whatever, you know, to have all these assaults on you, you know, you realize it's not necessarily smarter or better or morally superior either. You know, so why is this culture in control? And then when you realize it's built on a dynamic of aggression and hostility to other and fear, you know, you can't find any way to justify it after a certain point, because those are the kind of things that in this same dominant society, though they don't have a monopoly on that value, you're taught that that's not the way to treat people. You know, love, respect, humility, cooperation, gentleness, kindness, friendliness are supposed to be virtues that we should demonstrate toward each other. And when you don't see it, you know you're dealing with something bogus and inferior and malicious and malignant. And so I find myself not even wanting to watch the news or watch TV. I told you I was trying to do like a lot of us did, shelter in place, and I was watching this show, and I could only get to the first, I think, episode, two episodes. It was called Little Fires Everywhere. And I found myself triggered by the well-meaning progressive white female protagonist and the way she treated the black woman as though her life, her very being, was somehow inferior and in need of her support to validate it and legitimize it. And I'm thinking, oh no, I can't do this. So I'm looking for something else. And people tease me sometimes and say, why do you watch, you know, Sapphire and shows like Doctor Who or whatever? It's like, it was not like it's perfect. It's not. But at least you'll see folks of color in some kind of position where they have some self-determination and agency. Not all of the episodes by any means, because the early ones were just as bad as all the rest of society is, you know.
But you know, one thing that you mentioned in terms of having the opportunity to look at something, you know, in another world, you know, I had, you know, just trying to find some I don't want to say balm and gilly, just some peace. So I was, you know, looking at the opportunities, and I saw one of the film streaming services, and they had, I said, oh no, I can't watch this. They had, you know, they would, big thing was The Help, the movie.
Oh no, they're not.
And it was sort of like, maybe that was their attempt to affirm that Black lives matter, and you know, reaching out to the moment. And you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to get back to it in terms of your life experience and having living in white dominant culture, and I think all of us who are black have experiences, and how traumatic living in America is and can be. One of the things that recently that I've relived in a very strange way is something that I had, like, you know, experienced and packed in my memory banks was, you know, when I was a child, was that I didn't know I had the opportunity, or the reality was that I was part of a school busing plan, and certainly my parents and family prepared us, and you know, they were active in the struggle, and so, you know, maybe I thought that, yeah, we're doing the right thing, and certainly up until that point, my I had lived and surrounded in black culture, black neighborhoods, and maybe had a white teacher or two, I don't know. But so then came that day when we were bused to the other school, and you know, one thing I realized as a youngster was, you know, as the school bus went on to the other neighborhood, was like, oh, these houses are, you know, like our houses, and the neighborhood isn't that different. But you know, as we approached the school and noticed, you know, the crowd of people around, adults, a crowd of people as we approached the school, and of course they were protesting, and one thing that I remember really clearly, I mean, it's stamped in my mind, was this one man, you know, screaming with a Mayday, some sort of hat over his head, and it said, "No in here, you know, N word here," and you know, as a child, you take that in. You know, we got off the bus and walked into the school and, you know, carried on. But I'm just, you know, that's just something you experience. And that's what's part of life. And I'm sure my parents, I know my parents, you know, try to explain, you know, what was going on. I felt so blessed, maybe more so now than then, you know, having a family and a strong Black community that nurtured us and gave us the strength. But like those things that come back every once in a while was like, why did these adult people, why were they screaming at a bunch of kids, and why were they threatened? And again, that wasn't something that I thought about, but you know, over the past you know, 2 weeks, 10 days or so, like that came again. And you know, then go into a white prep school in New England, and you know, some of those experiences, and it's like, oh gosh, you know, we live in some of those things. So these triggers things that happens, and for me at least, I most of the time I'm at that place these past few days is that not that I don't want to relive those things or have those things come to my mind again. You know, that's part of who I am and that's part of my experience. But right now, I don't want to be engaged in long arguments or debates. I just I don't want to try to explain to people in the dominant culture, as you said before, who don't experience these things. Or just one of the articles you sent me was, what do you do when you're suddenly with people who are suddenly woke, you know?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be Black?
What does woke me even mean nowadays? You know, it's not like, if you are really just seeing this right now as a person of white culture, and by a person of white culture, I mean you have what people call white skin privilege, or you have been raised in such a way that the dominant culture is your design overlay in thinking and relating to the world. So
why don't you say that? Why don't you say those again? Those are very important points. White skin privilege, or
white skin privilege, or you have grown up with the mindset of white culture, and it's more of a design overlay. What that means is you have been privileged to believe that your success is based on your hard work only, and not in any way held back by the color of your skin or your ethnicity or your ancestry. There are a lot of people of color who think that they have made it on the basis of their hard work. Clarence Thomas is one, a very prominent one. And, you know, there are a lot of others. The point being that why are you now woke? What happened? Because nothing has changed. Nothing. The only thing that is even remotely different, if you will, is that you saw it and you processed it like most of the people of color who were either at the scene or have been through similar situations have described it. You ever see that movie Amistad?
Oh, yes.
Okay, I've only seen it once because I couldn't go through it, and it was more than I could handle almost. There's that pivotal scene where I believe he was a senator. Right now, my mind doesn't want to even grab key details. But he argued the point that these people who were regarded as property but were really people, should be free, and that whatever they did was because they were fighting for their inalienable right for freedom. And the rest of the legislative body agreed. Now, people think, oh, this is wonderful, because they had a crisis of conscience or something like that. And all it was is that for whatever reason, they decided to play by the rules that they have written in the book for everybody else. See? Mm-hmm. And there, you know, that was just one moment in time. One moment in time. And it's not like it caused a groundswell of change, so that at that particular moment, everybody became woke and chattel slavery in the United States was abolished. It didn't happen. You know, it went for years longer, decades, yeah, centuries. Okay. So I'm looking at this and I'm trying not to have the jaundice eye and say, okay, where is this going? This is no different than Rodney King. This is also no different in many words than what happened to Eric Garner. What was Eric Garner's words? He said, I can't breathe. Here we are some years later, and a man said the same thing. You know? And as a matter of fact, one of the articles I sent you, because I know there's no way you could have read them all, hon, I'm sorry, but it was a black man who was disoriented, and EMTs were trying to help him, and one of the officers tased him, and then when he fell down, they flipped him over, got on his back, and another officer put the taser to his neck, and this was just a few days ago, and the man said, I can't breathe. Now, he was under the influence of something. Either he'd had a head injury or was going through substance abuse or who knows what. He might have been in a diabetic state. Who knows? But all I know is that they decided that force was the response that was necessary. And it's so endemic in this white culture, you know, that I can't help but wonder, what are we seeing when we're seeing these outpourings and protests? Is this a temporary thing, like it was when these white men in the legislative body freed the slaves who were part of the Amistad cargo? Or is this a real turn of heart that's going to be a permanent change? Because again,
one thing how I view these things, and that's a very good question, and it may lead to either, it might spur to people to saying, oh, this is the moment, things are going to, it's a bright new future, or it may lead, or other people respond, oh, been there, done that, yeah, it has happened before. And I explain how I interpret events, the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, is that it's not either or. I think it's like a virus, and it takes different forms in different eras. And so while it's very important to confront, to battle, to challenge the evil as it's manifested in this day and this place, that battle is a worthy one, and people should be involved in it. It does not mean that things will suddenly be better. In 1839, when the Amistad case came before that court, and Singh Bay and the others, you know, chanted, "We be free," in terms of what they wanted. Yes, there was temporary reprieve or opportunity, and for a moment, for those 53 African people, they experienced some sort of freedom. But chattel slavery remained in America for another couple of decades, at least. So those battles, that battle was an important one, and to continue, it may have spurred other people to white people to battle for the abolition of slavery in the United States. But that doesn't mean that even when that battle was won, that things were better forever, and that we need to seize the moment. And yes, this might be a momentary, but I think it's important to seize the moment and to be involved in the demands of the moment, and not to discourage people, spurring people onward. But also, I think for those who are part of the freedom struggle, recognize the long arc of history, and to recognize that this evil system will not be overcome this year, this decade, and as I mentioned earlier, it morphs and takes different forms in different places. So yes, let us seize upon the moment and continue to battle for very specific change, but I also want us to be aware that this is an evil beast, and it's going to remain with us in many different ways.
You are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metropolitan area, 91.9 if you're in points east along the Columbia River Gorge, Hood River, Oregon, White Summit, Washington, and Philomath, Oregon, it is 104.3. And it is KBOO.FM everywhere else. Well, everywhere. This is More Talk Radio. I'm here with my co-host, Cecil Prescott. My name is Celeste Gary. And today we're just kind of trying to unpack our perceptions of what's going on. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, when I was doing the restorative listening project with two colleagues, we would have people listen to the stories of folks without a need to be questioned or validated or cross-examined or anything. The idea was to listen and to hear. And so we're just sharing thoughts and impressions about where we are now, how we're trying to process things. One of the things I did was send Cecil a bunch of articles that I had either read or saved or, pretty much read. One of them I found really interesting in the CNN business section. And it was what CEOs and managers should be doing for black employees. And it starts out with pretty much the same thing Cecil and I did by saying, many black Americans carry generations of grief and fury and fear, and that all three of these are frequently reinforced by the truly horrifying spectacles like the killing of George Floyd. And for many black employees, trying to be professional, actually trying to be functional, let alone professional, in the age that we're in right now, is more than can be managed. And it's really important that those in the position of supervisor or manager recognize this. This is not a lapse in professionalism, or this is not, what is the word, malingering. Malingering, when you pretended to be ill. This is really a devastation of soul and psyche, in that you're trying to process things that are horrific that you have seen and heard of most of your life, and so is your family members, and this trauma has been passed down, and you're supposed to, you know, walk it off, you know, shake it off, you know, fake it till you make it, whatever, so that you can still be part of the economic and employment and workaday machinery, and that's an insult to humanity, that right there, that expectation. And so the thought is, you know, you as management need to, you need to give people a room of a space to heal. And so one of the first things that even says in the article is don't expect people to educate you. I already told you my thoughts on that. It's like, no, white culture is so good at examining and dissecting and analyzing everything.
Let's have a conversation.
Yeah, it's like, no, you know what it is. How would you feel, you know? And then it says something along the lines of adopt a sense of urgency to remedy racial inequities at your company. Well, okay, you may not be the boss. Maybe you are a coworker and colleague or peer. But what does that mean to you? You know, you should know the things you're saying have an effect on a person, the things you do. You know, think about your conversation. Think about how you've been trained both directly and indirectly, both formally and informally, how to put people of color in their place. You know, think about that. You know what things you've been taught, like, hi, you look lost. Can I help you? What are you doing here? Let me show you how to do that. Is that what you really mean? Oh, surely it's not like that now. You know, you have to dismantle so much of that collective corrective spirit, you know, that puts people in their place. Nowadays we call them microaggressions.
Yeah.
And you know how you felt when they've been used against you, whether it's because you weren't the right white, in other words, you weren't educated at the right place, you didn't live in the right neighborhood, you don't wear the right clothes, you don't have the right accent, you didn't say that word properly, and immediately you feel out of place because, well, there's a hierarchy and somebody made you snap too. You know how to not do that. And that's really the fundamental place to start. That's something that everybody can do, is look at how you are treating somebody as other.
Yeah.
And a lesser other. You know, that's the other part. Yeah. It's not just other, but a lesser, an inferior. And, I mean, I'm not perfect. I have my own struggles, you know. I have my own struggles, but I tell you, it's that self-reflection and looking at myself that helps me change. And if you don't look at yourself and see how you're using the culture of whiteness to give you a worth that is based on subjecting somebody else, if you won't take the time to look at that, you know, you're going to be caught up in the same maelstrom, the same dynamic.
Yeah, I think, well, a couple of thoughts that occur to me is that maybe, you know, part of the challenge is that is that we are not aware. We are not aware of our privilege, and as you suggested, it's something. Maybe that's the beginning point, is just knowing that we are not aware of. And I think we all are caught up in this system somehow. We take on the values unconsciously, so it's just in the fabric of of our society, and it seeps into the innermost part of our individual collective being that white is right. And I think that we all have to be aware of how it impacts us. Now, as a cisgender, academically educated male, you know, there's stuff that I do and experience, and I need to not only be aware of, but to challenge those things within myself, and not be afraid of being challenged, of saying, of being in position of giving up my power, and to be in a position where I'm just there to listen, and then not only to listen. Gosh, I'm so sick and tired of conversations sometimes, but also to take action to, in religious terms, to repent, to turn away from, to give up, and to participate in the revolutionary overthrow of a system that exists. And certainly not comfortable. And it ought not to be. It ought not to be.
No, for sure. It ought not to be. You know, among those articles I sent you was one from Forbes magazine. And
yes.
It's about a man who passed a counterfeit $20 bill. His name, Mark McCoy, 44-year-old white man who is also an archaeology professor in Dallas, Texas. And he recounts how he went in to use this counterfeit money, and at no time did he worry about this going sideways.
You mean he wasn't hogtied and beaten?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. And, you know, he says it was his white privilege, meaning inherent advantages that he possessed by being a cisgendered white male. And therefore, he was in a superior position so that whatever he did wrong, it could be excused. Now, the thing that I find really interesting is that he thinks that because he had white skin like the officers, he was immune. But I was kind of amused by the fact that he referenced himself as being Irish American. Because my paternal grandfather was Irish from, as they say, fresh off the boat, you know. Yeah. And when he got here, he wasn't white. And so it's really interesting how that white privilege has been conferred upon people arbitrarily. But,
yeah,
so, you know,
so like as soon as you get off of the boat, like, ta-da, you become white.
Well, no, he didn't ta-da become white yet. You know, as a matter of fact, he married my father's mother, who was Algonquin Indian, and so he lived in Kentucky, which was not a white state, you know, but that's where a lot of the Scots and the Irish and Native and Creole people, both of the French Creole characterization and then Creole of the Spanish characterization were, you know, and so he was not white. But the funny thing is, this man, you know, demonstrates how privilege is conferred, because he was saying while George Floyd is gone, you know, he is here to tell the story, and he hopes that people, especially white people, will hear it not only as a cautionary tale, but also a tale to help break that spell that exists in white America that all of us are treated equally under the law.
All right. Yeah. And when I think of, yeah, that's the point I was making in terms of the privilege that is granted. So when I said you step off of the boat, you become white, it's sort of like all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but in our society, privilege is granted. And
yes.
And that happens.
It happens. I mean, we don't have to go any further than just looking at how COVID-19 has impacted communities of color,
right.
And especially Black folks. And people want to characterize and say, well, you must be doing something wrong because you've got all these underlying factors. And I remember we didn't learn it as metabolic syndrome when I was in nursing school, because they hadn't really figured that out yet. They mm-hmm. did understand that hypertension was due possibly to stress that folks of color experienced, and not just diet. But, you know, metabolic syndrome, as it was called some years ago, is that condition that comes from an excess of cortisol in your body, which is the stress hormone, which makes your large muscles resistant to insulin and can cause you to become pre-diabetic and to have high cholesterol and hypertension, high blood pressure. And studies have shown that children who are suffering in abused homes or stress in school or being bullied have high levels of cholesterol. And so they're figuring mm-hmm. that perhaps cholesterol is a result of high levels of stress and cortisol, which is, again, the fight or flight hormone. And so people under siege have metabolic syndrome, which leads to all these underlying conditions that COVID seems to, you know, feast on. And
right.
So, you know, people want to say, oh, those Black people, all they do is eat greasy foods and don't exercise and drink too much and they're fat and lazy. It's like, no, you could be running around frantically trying to take care of business, being professional, working yourself into a frenzy, and still suffer from metabolic syndrome and end up having a stroke or heart attack or develop diabetes, and you're still trying to do the right things because the stress is overcoming much of what you're doing to help yourself.
Indeed.
You know?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as we approach the end of the hour, I wanted to go back on maybe a point you made or opened up a little while ago, and also not to bring closure, but to allow people to take action where they can. You mentioned earlier about, you know, the article from, was it in Forbes or something like that, about the CEOs and stuff like that. And also, and that's fine. And you know, at another time I might talk about how I'm laughing at how the NFL was forced to, the commissioner of the NFL was forced to tell the players to say the right word without mentioning Colin Kaepernick, you know. But you know, but I also think it's important for us to find out where we are and what we can do. And what brought this to mind was I, you know, looking at social media and articles and things, I'm fascinated by how people are responding. And one of the things that I was intrigued by, a response by how all these different organizations and groups who are feeling called to, I'll say, to make stands or statements about why this is an important moment and what they can do and why Black Lives Matter. And some of these things are certainly like big organizations and stuff like that, you know, Fortune 500 to bottom, you know, look at the bottom line for them, the dollars. But also,
mm-hmm.
I think that there are many groups
who is saying, well, I'm not necessarily all organizations, that's not who we are. We're not that. But what I'm intrigued by is how organizations can find how Black Lives Matters and what they can do. So I was intrigued by, I'll just name a couple of local nonprofit organizations. One was Oregon Walks. And I said, okay, this is a group that talks about promoting pedestrians and pedestrian rights. But they had a very fascinating statement of reflection about why, for their organization, Black Lives Matter, and how they interpret the signs of the times. So coming from their perspective, I think that's all of us. We aren't called to be something we are not. We are called to say, well, how does this impact my world and what I can do differently? And then the other organization I mentioned, and I will not pronounce the acronym correctly, PICA, right?
Oh, PICA.
PICA. And they had been posting daily things that people can do. Now, you would think, why would an art organization be involved? Or why, you know, why is that part of their mission? But they felt it was something that they needed to do and say as an outgrowth of who they are. And so I think all of us, whether we are an art organization or a faith community or a medical profession, much like things that occurred in the movements as we read back in the 60s and the 70s, our organization spoke out against the war, although they were not necessarily anti-war organizations, nurses and doctors and teachers. Our organization began to participate in the rights of civil rights movement, although they were not Black led, or in the feminist movement of the 70s. Wherever you are, you have a sphere of influence and you can do something and make a change where you are. So begin where you are.
Amen to that. And, you know, there's no conclusion to this conversation. We'll probably have it again. But I do want to leave you with a song. It's by a young man who, well, he was young then, performed with Prince. His name is Andre Simone. And no relation to Nina. He spells his name totally differently. But the album is an extended play song album. It's called Black Man in America. And I'll just leave you with that, because this is about hopefully stirring up conversation, provoking thoughts, challenging mental and structural and institutional paradigms, and finding a way to be more of who you are supposed to be, like these organizations extending themselves. Be more of who you're supposed to be a bridge to someplace beyond you, and to be a hand holding on to another's. And Cecil and I will hear you next week here on More Talk Radio on your Community Connection, KBOO. And thanks to our engineer, Sonia. We'll catch you later.
Lane. Brothers getting shot, no hesitation. A way of life for a generation. Yes, it's all true. You don't understand. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. We've been struggling 50 years, sacrificed through blood and tears, just trying to break through to this here promised land. You don't know what it's like to be a black man in America.
right where you stay. History, Hollywood, image of the black man ain't no good. That's how they sell you. It's their master plan. Across the street, you lock your door, cut your purse and enter the Lord. Won't let me see you. What did I do wrong? Try to get a job on the application. When you check back for the information, they don't call you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.